Hello and welcome to episode 109 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum here at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Toedy, former skipper of the fast attack submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor, and many other postings. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Seth.
This week, Bill and I have a return guest with us, and as such, I would like to welcome back my friend and amazing historian, John Parshall. John, how are you this morning?
Oh, living the dream.
Aren't we all?
Yeah, exactly.
Aren't we all?
Carrying myself away from Ukraine, you know, for long enough to talk about the Pacific War. So
Yeah.
It's a distraction.
It's been a good week for Ukraine as well, though.
Indeed.
So if you listened last week as we set up the battle we are about to discuss, we left you as the sun was setting on the night of June 3rd, 1942. Or as the sun set on the night of June 3rd. A lot has happened over the last few hours. PBY Catalinas from Midway have discovered the incoming Japanese invasion fleet and have attacked it successfully, somewhat, with, of all things, a PBY that dropped a torpedo. And we'll get to torpedoes in a little bit. That being said, the nighttime torpedo attack does not turn the invasion fleet away. Surprise, surprise. The train keeps on chugging along. So with that, and because we got a ton to talk about today, we're going to pick up right where we left off, right around 0300 hours on June 4th aboard the Japanese and American carriers. John, what is it looking like on the Japanese carriers right now?
They are up very early this morning. A lot of the hangar crewmen are probably up around 0230. The pilots will probably sleep a little bit later if they are capable of sleeping at this point. So arming activities are going on aboard the carriers probably from 0300 onward, getting these birds ready, fueled up, in many cases armed with land attack bombs on the level bombers. They're going to put the dive bombers up on the flight deck, and when they lift the level bombers up there, they're going to be warming all of their aircraft engines up. So it's this huge choreographed operation happening on all four of these carriers simultaneously to get this attack force of 108 aircraft up on the flight decks, warmed up and ready to take off by 0430.
What are they briefed about? Like, what is their, you know, what is their mission today? What are they trying to do?
You know, we don't know that much about the specific briefing details, but the operation is intended to put Midway Island out of business. And so they are going to hit it with level bombers that are going to be aimed primarily at the runways and the aircraft handling facilities. And then that's going to be followed up immediately afterwards with dive bomber attacks by two squadrons of dive bombers that are supposed to go after point targets, frankly, mostly anti-aircraft installations and that sort of thing. Because they're going to be invading this place, hopefully within a day or two. So they need to reduce the island's defenses to impotence before their soldiers go ashore.
So at roughly the same time, you said they're up about 0230-ish, 0300. Yep. At roughly the same time, the same thing's going on aboard the U.S. carriers. The air crews, the Reveille that morning is 0300. By 0330, they're serving chow. And excuse me, you know, the Japanese CVs haven't been discovered yet, but the air crew aboard Yorktown Enterprise and Hornet know that, you know, as a friend of mine used to say, the defecation is going to hit the ventilation at some point during the day, and they're getting ready to go. You know, much like you were saying about the Japanese, and we'd said in the previous episode about, you know, restless sleep or any lack thereof, the same kind of things going on this morning. You know, there's they're serving breakfast, they're serving the warriors breakfast, you know, steak and eggs, and aboard all three carriers. And it's I remember guys saying that they Don Hoff specifically saying, and you will hear about him later, he kind of moved the eggs around the plate, you know, he wasn't very hungry. And it was he used to tell me, he said that breakfast among the air crew, especially the gunners and scouting six, it was a jovial group. You know, you couldn't go by at least, you know, 30 seconds without hearing somebody make derogatory comments about somebody else's mother or something like that. But on the morning of June the 4th, there was none of that.
Everybody was
silent as the grave.
Yeah, I think you see some of the same sort of behavior on the Japanese carriers as well. We know, for instance, that a lot of the men changed into fresh clothes, probably, you know, showered or, you know, bathed at least. And that was not an everyday kind of thing when you're under wartime steaming conditions. So, you know, a lot of these guys are definitely girding themselves for what they know is going to be a pretty long day ahead of them.
Who's the strike leader, the Japanese strike leader?
He's a gentleman named Tomonaga Joichi. He's a lieutenant. He is Hiryu's air group commander. And I'm sorry, I've got a cat named Akagi down here mewing in the background.
Okay. A cat named Akagi?
A cat named Akagi, yeah.
Do you name all your cats after Japanese aircraft carriers?
Yeah, the first two were Soryu and Hiryu. That was Cat.
Is that right?
Cat Div 2, and we've got Cat Div 1 now. So,
John, you've been doing this too long.
Kitty Butai is a thing here at the house.
Yeah.
Kitty Butai.
Kitty Butai, that's correct. Tomonaga is a China vet. He has not been aboard the carrier force before. He's an experienced aviator. He's going to be leading the strike this morning because the guy who would have been in charge, Fuchida, Mitsuo Fuchida, had an appendicitis a few days ago and was laid up in sick bay. Fuchida manages to kind of crawl up to Akagi's bridge this morning. So he's going to be a witness to it, most of the day's events.
And Fuchida is a veteran of which battles before this?
Pretty much everything. I mean,
everything,
Fuchida
right?
is Pearl Akagi's Harbor. Air group leader. He was the strike leader at Pearl Harbor. Fuchida's a very charismatic individual, a tremendous leader, was handpicked by Genda to be the strike leader for Pearl Harbor because he knows that Fuchida's got the charisma and the leadership skills to kind of, you know, cajole this big group of airmen into being a coordinated unit. But yeah, he's out of it this morning because he is still recovering from this appendicitis.
I don't like to do what ifs, and I'm not going to propose it as such, but how much do you think him not being a part of this does anything, or does it do anything at all?
I don't think it does anything at all.
Okay.
I'm very much I'm not an anti-great man historian, but I'm very much of the mindset that these sorts of wars are wars of systems. Mm-hmm. And that Fuchida is a product of the military system. I don't see anything that he could have done differently that, you know, Tomonaga wouldn't have done.
Gotcha.
So
that's fair enough.
The theory of systems actually is a pretty old theory in the U.S. Navy. In fact, the debate before even World War One was, does the fleet operate as a system or an organism?
Right.
And that went back and forth, you know, from the earliest days of the 20th century. And I agree with you that the personalities, once you got the motions in place, the big hero personalities pretty much removed from the dynamics of what was happening, with right. some notable exceptions. I mean, decisions made by people like Spruance during Midway, I think, or and Halsey, you know, in Guadalcanal, and we could talk about sure. that later, right? But the system is what allows adaptability in
Correct.
Situ. And one could argue that it was the Japanese adherence to dogma over adaptability that was part of what led to their downfall.
Well,
but we could talk about that.
We're going to talk about that later this afternoon because I have right. some pretty pointed comments regarding some of the Japanese admirals later on today. But yeah, in terms of what's going down this morning, the strike force is in perfectly good hands because Tomonaga knows what he's doing. And furthermore, all of the air groups involved in this operation know what they're doing as well.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, this is the cream of the crop, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and Japanese deck operations at this point are just a well-oiled machine. So, mm-hmm. you know, what you see is when they start launching at 0430, they put up 108 aircraft, 30 planes per ship or thereabouts, and a little more than that. It's about 33 when you kick in the cap fighters that are going mm-hmm. up at the same time and all that. They get that entire strike force off, formed up in the air and on the way to the target in about 10 minutes.
God, that's incredible. That's yeah. absolutely incredible.
The Americans,
that's a lot of rehearsal.
Yeah, a lot of rehearsal. You know, oh, they yeah. really know what they're doing.
And just to reprise just a moment, the Americans are assembling at Point Lunk. They expect the fleets to appear somewhere. They don't want the American aircraft carriers to take off and give away the fact that the American aircraft carriers are there. So they're doing recon using land-based airplanes, right?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, the Americans have no idea where the Japanese are. Yeah. They don't even know that they're here. I mean, all they've got in terms of hard intel is that we know that there's an invasion force coming. Mm-hmm. And again, we've moved, you know, I say we, the Americans have actually moved west from Point Luck. Point Luck is, you know, way in the mirror at this point. So,
So aboard Midway Island, you said that Japanese launch at 0430. Rough time estimation for PBY's taken off is 0415 from Midway Island.
Yeah. We have planes up first.
Yeah. So we're actually ahead of the game.
Yep.
Granted, by 15 minutes, but 15 minutes can mean a hell of a lot.
Slower airplanes, though, right? Yeah. The PBY's were slower than the Caribbean. Oh,
for sure. But we're out putting our fingers out in the air trying to find what we can find. Everything that's going down on the island, and this is what makes this so cool, is that there's so many moving parts happening at the same exact time. It's kind of unbelievable. At the same time that the Japanese are launching and heading towards Midway Island, the PBYs are already up in the air. The American aircraft on the island, and I'm talking about VMSB 241, 221, VMF 221, anything that can fly that's going to see action here in the next couple of hours, they're fueled up. They're armed. They're ready to go. The pilots are doing whatever they need to be doing. They're getting ready to go. And
one thing I'd like to interject too, that a lot of people ask me, you know, did the Midway aviators know that the Americans had carriers in the area? Well, certainly the base commander knew. I mean, Simmons knew what was going on.
Nimitz had visited him not too long ago, right?
May 2nd, but this is all before. So I remember Bert saying, specifically Bert and the Marines that I knew, Leon Williams and Sumner Witten, guys like that, they did not know that the carriers were there.
Okay.
The first time that they knew that the American carriers were there or were anywhere near them is when Hornets VB-8
had to land.
Landed on Midway Island later in the day. That's the first time they had any inkling that American aircraft carriers were out there.
Right.
So the timeline we're going
to came from Shangri-La, right?
Like that,
But
last thing I'd like to interject too, because this is going to be important when we're talking later on about what's happening on the Japanese flight decks. One of the reasons that this evolution of you know, deck operations takes a long time to kind of front load is that they do have to warm up their aircraft engines on the flight deck, because unlike American carriers, the Japanese carriers had enclosed hangar spaces, and so you couldn't warm up an engine down, you know, in the hangars itself. It had to be on the flight deck, and that's a process that takes, depending on the ambient temperature, you know, 15, 20 minutes or something like that. So, you know, the total time that it takes actually from the time somebody says go and you start pulling planes out of the hangar decks and getting them up on the flight deck, this is about a 40 to 45 minute evolution.
And those enclosed hangar decks are going to come back to haunt
four
specific aircraft carriers in a little while.
In a little while.
So what time is about 10 minutes to six-ish that the PBY spot Kyudobutai?
Yeah.
Ish, something like 5:52, I think it was.
Right.
So, John, take us through the Midway strike, the Japanese Midway strike. Give us a rundown. What happens here? What's going down?
So, you know, the Japanese force comes in, like I say, 108 minus a couple of planes that have, you know, some mechanicals and that sort of thing. They approach in a very nice tight, formation from the northwest. The Marines send up what fighters they are capable of sending up to do their thing. The Marines actually get some licks in and knock a couple of those Japanese planes down. You know, I'll let you cover the blow by blow from the Marines. It's not a pretty sight. They find out very quickly that the Zero is a really good fighter, and gosh, the guys that fly them for Kyudobutai really know what they're doing. So, you know, the Marine fighters in most cases are able to make maybe one pass against the attacking force, and then they're just swatted aside. Mm-hmm. The Japanese level bombers come in and do their thing, starting at about 0634. They paced, they basically come in, they circle around the island and come in from the northeast to go down kind of the long axis of each of the two islands that are in the atoll hit the airfield, hit the fuel tanks, blow up some barracks. And then about 5 minutes later, the dive bombers come in one at a time against each island, a squadron apiece for each of the islands, and are doing their thing. But, you know, the attack is all over within, it doesn't last more than about 7 or 8 minutes, really. And at that point, the Japanese are off to a reassembly point off to the west of the islands, pull all their squadrons together, and then start heading back to the carriers.
Yeah, and forgive me for this, but this is the legendary director John Ford was on Midway.
He was.
And filmed all of this and actually got wounded, right? Mm-hmm. And since he was a reserve naval officer at this point, he was awarded the Purple Heart.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was pretty amazing from the standpoint. Later, he was on D-Day. But, I mean, at this point, pretty amazing and coincidental, almost serendipitous, that he was there to record all this. And this is really some of the first big-time movie footage that the American people will see in newsreels in the months to come.
And it ranks among some of the only photographic evidence that we have of the battle.
Right.
You know, For a battle of this magnitude, the quantity of decent photographs that come out of it, either moving pictures or still photography, is just laughable.
Yeah. Small. It's virtually nil. I mean, frankly, it really is.
Anyway,
so it's important to note that before the Japanese ever strike the island, and as soon as the word gets out, you know, that the Japanese, I mean, not the Japanese, that the PBYs spot the Japanese carriers, Midway launches everything with wings.
Yep.
If it can fly, it's in the air, and it's on the way to wherever it was that the Japanese aircraft were spotted, or Japanese aircraft carriers were spotted. And that includes the SBDs and the wind indicators from VMS B-241, the fighters we already mentioned about. They're not going to the Japanese carriers. This is VMF-221s. These are F-4Fs and F-2A Brewsters. They're going to hover and attack the incoming Japanese aircraft. But I mean, this is everything, man. This is the B-26s. This is everything that Nimitz piled on that island. The TBFs, Bird Ernest, all those guys, the 17s are all, everything's gone. Everything is gone.
Coming up from Hawaii in most cases. But yeah, because there's a group of 17s that are up. They were slated to attack the invasion convoy again. But then when they get word that, you know, we've sighted the Japanese carriers, they reroute and start. Yeah, a couple of things that come out of that. One, because of the polyglot nature of the air group and the fact that it is composed of Marine aircraft, Navy aircraft, and Air Corps aircraft, that all have extremely variable cruising speeds and are launched, you know, in one long sequence, they are not going to show up at the Japanese carrier force in any sort of an integrated strike package. Mm-hmm. The two groups that come in first are going to be the TBFs and the B-26s, and even they are not coordinated in any meaningful fashion. They're coming in two separate flights. That's one thing that happens. The other is that the Japanese are very quickly aware of the fact that they have not put this place out of business. The strike leader, Tomonaga, sends, as soon as he's got his aircraft kind of put back together again, couple of things you realize is, one, the anti-aircraft fire over Midway was intense, and when they left, it was still intense, which means that we have not put this place out of business. And as they're going to discover when they land this force later in the morning, they've lost 11 aircraft shot down, another 14 or 15 seriously damaged. Half of the planes in the strike force were hit by anti-aircraft fire. Mm-hmm. So in terms of lost aircraft and write-offs, they lost a quarter of their attack force in the course of 7 minutes.
Yeah. That's so throwing a lot of lead in the air.
Yeah. I mean, American anti-aircraft, even at this point in the war, is nothing to sneeze at. Mm-hmm. So Tomonaga then sends this canned message back to the carrier force at 0700. Kawa, 0700. So this is clearly a pre-packaged code group that they had sitting in his back pocket that means, yeah, sure enough, we have not put Midway out of business and we are going to need a second
strike. Yeah.
Yep. So that happens at 0700. You want to talk about what happened in the air-to-air fight?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, you touched on it when the Japanese are coming into the island, they're hit by Red Parks as fighters. Floyd Parks was his name. Red was his nickname, call sign, whatever you want to call it. He's a Marine Corps aviator. He's a squadron commander for VMF 221. And he's got kind of a half and half squadron. He's got Wildcats, F4, F3s, and he's got F2A3 Brewster Buffaloes. And like you said, I mean, they give a fairly decent account of themselves, considering what it is and who they are and what and who they're attacking here. But by and large, they are a one strike and done. They're coming in, they're making one pass if they can get that.
If they can get that.
And then they're getting the hell out of there or they're getting shot down. Parks gets himself, he gets shot down and killed in action. A gentleman that we mentioned in the earlier and in the last episode, a guy named Bill Brooks, he's flying a Brewster. He comes in, and this is the guy that was resigned to his fate, you know, that he didn't think he was going to see another sunset. He's comes in and he does make a high side run. He positions himself. This is his first combat. This is his baptism of fire. He positions himself in such a way that he can make a high side run, I believe, on a Val as it's pulling out of its dive. Yeah. And he does lay some hits onto one of these aircraft. He actually attacks two. And whether he shoots it down or not, you know, is anybody's guess. You know, nobody knows. But as he's pulling out of that attack, he's jumped on by like three or four Zeros. And they are just shredding him. The Brewster doesn't have the speed to get away. It can't. Damn sure isn't going to outclimb a Zero. And you got to remember, too, as he's making that high side run, he's diving on the Japanese aircraft. So now he's like, he can't dive away, because if he does, he's going to go into the damn water. Yeah. Yeah. He ain't getting away. So what he does, the only thing, and he's smart enough to realize this, the only way he can get these enemy aircraft off his tail is to fly directly over the landing, the tarmac. Mm-hmm. So every gun on that island is shooting at him, but it's also shooting at the Japanese aircraft that are trailing him. That's the only way he can get these people off his ass. And with whatever speed is left in that Brewster, he does that very thing. And it works. You know, he's shot to pieces, but he does put the aircraft down. It's a total loss, but his hide is saved. You know, he does get to see another sunset. But I always thought, when he told me that, I always thought that was pretty damn smart in the heat of the battle to know, I can't shake these cats. They are going to kill me.
And at this point, he wasn't making this as a calculated decision where he says, I know my airplane can take that those hits better than the Zero because the Zero is so vulnerable. No. He's just desperate, and he thinks it's the only way.
The only way he can save his hide is to come over the top of the island and let his fellow Marines, hopefully not shoot him down, but shoot the Japanese down. And that's kind of what happens.
Which of the Marine aviators described the experience as like being hung on a piece of string while the Zeros, you know, kind of made their passes at
us? Oh, man.
I can't remember, but
I don't recall. I know what you're talking about, but I don't recall.
Was a frightening opponent, very, very fast and nimble. And again, these are extremely experienced Japanese aviators.
Mm. Yeah. And they're shredding those guys. And I mean, after that incident, if you want to call it that, VMF 221 kind of ceases to exist.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what little aircraft they have that are, you know, that don't get shot to Swiss cheese, you know, I mean, you can count them on one hand.
Yeah.
So they're hit. Almost every airplane in their inventory is hit in some way, shape, or form. And no Brewsters that fly after this.
At this point, where Midway is definitely under attack by the American carrier aircraft up in the air? Mm-mm. Not yet. Yeah.
Because, you know, they're still far enough away from a potential launch point. You know, as soon as the Americans have actionable intelligence in their hands, Fletcher and Spruance, you know, basically Fletcher's got his aircraft from Yorktown up doing a search. And he has positioned Task Force 16 as basically to be his shooting arm, you know, for the first strike. And so he basically tells Spruance, take your two carriers to the southwest as rapidly as possible and launch when you can. And as soon as I bring down my morning search planes, I'm going to follow up behind you and do the same. So the American carriers now are moving to the Southwest, trying to get into a launch position, but they're not going to be there.
They don't have precise enough location yet of the Japanese carriers.
Also true. And yeah, okay, so we got some sighting reports, a little before 0600, but of course those carriers are going to be, the enemy carriers will be moving in the meantime, right, before I can get planes up in the air.
Right.
So meanwhile, back on the Japanese carriers, Nagumo's got to figure out what to do. And he's been endlessly pilloried for the decisions that he makes. And understand that even by this point in the battle, he's kind of behind the eight ball and doesn't even know it. His own scouting plan has fallen apart. He's put up seven aircraft, one of which took off late. And unfortunately, the one that really had the best shot of finding the American carriers, a scout plane from Chikuma, either was hot dogging his route or was flying above the cloud cover and couldn't see anything. But they should have detected the Americans at around 0615, and they did not.
But one of the myths is that that plane that took off late, he was responsible for the Japanese failing to detect the Americans, right?
That's Tone number 4 airplane, piloted by a guy named Amari. And he gets to be the scapegoat for until our book is written, frankly. Although it was Dallas Isom, I will say in all fairness, some of the Naval War College articles that he wrote when we were arguing back and forth, it was Dallas who first pointed out that actually Amari must have misflown his route intentionally, or he cut his dog leg too soon. But he ends up detecting the Americans probably 40 to 45 minutes earlier than he should have if he had actually flown his correct search pattern. So, but Nagumo doesn't know that yet. We're at 0700, right? Nagumo's just gotten this message from Tomonaga. There's a need for a second strike. As far as Nagumo knows, I've got my planes up. They haven't seen anything out there in terms of any enemy naval forces. I know, too, that it's a time-honored principle that operational tempo is important. And if there's going to be a second strike against Midway, I should hit them again as rapidly as possible. I've still got half of my aircraft here that are supposedly armed for anti-ship operations. But in light of the fact that I haven't seen any Americans, he considers this for about 15 minutes and then he issues orders at 0715, rearm yourselves for a land attack mission and you're going to go out and you're going to hit Midway later on. So that's what goes down in 0715.
So to go back on Nagumo's decision, there really was no decision to make. I mean, he got word that he had to go, or that they should attack the island again. No carriers sighted,
right?
So he's like, well, what the hell? I mean, so there really is or shouldn't be any controversy at that point.
There shouldn't be. I mean, the people that say, oh, he disobeyed his order by not keeping his planes, well, okay, so the alternative then is you're going to wait for Tomonaga and his boys, who have lost a quarter of their attack force. They're going to come back at around 0830 or something. We're going to land them. We're going to give them lunch. We're going to refuel and rearm those damaged aircraft. And we're going to put Tomonaga and his boys back up sometime later in the afternoon. And they're going to go hit Midway again.
Which would take way more than 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, the reserve strike force are apparently just, sunning themselves on the flight deck with nothing better to do. I mean, as we said, Tony and I said in the book, the whole notion is asinine. Of course you're going to use your second group of aircraft to get them again.
So let's talk about your book then just for a second before we get back into the fun stuff of the battle.
Yeah.
So here's the book, Shattered Sword. This story is about Midway had been written since 1945 and rewritten. And you and John and Tony Tully are thought of as, kind of like probably the best historians of the Battle of Midway, at least from the point of view, from the Americans telling the Japanese story in the world right now. And what the heck did you discover that revolutionized or changed the way we're thinking when for a story that's been told for decades?
Yeah.
The truth.
Well, I just, to be humble here, we kind of got lucky. I mean, Tony and I have both been interested in the Japanese Navy since we were kids. And we also got in touch with good people like John Lundstrom, who's like, oh, if you're going to write a battle or a book on the Japanese side of the battle, you got to talk to my buddy Jim Saruk, who has translated all of the Japanese air group records for the battle. And that is the key. That was the piece of information that no other historians had before I started working on this thing. So the problem for the American scholarship was that the Battle of Midway was built on three primary sources from the Japanese side. One is Nagumo's after-action report, and there's a series of interviews that are done of Japanese naval officers after the war, the strategic bombing survey interviews. And then there's Fuchida's book, which came out in the early 1950s. And unfortunately, Fuchida's book is kind of a pack of lies. But nobody had the air group records before. And if you have those air group records, you're able to have very detailed information on, you know, when everybody went up.
Written contemporaneously as the battle was going on.
Exactly.
Yeah. So and it turns out the written histories didn't agree with the official documents and records that were being kept as planes were landing and being reloaded.
That's right? Exactly right. So,
and so that's, that had to have been an enormous amount of work to
reconcile. We really didn't start getting a hold of, and we're sort of fast forwarding here to what the flight deck controversy when we get to the dive bomber attack. Yeah, the bottom line is that we benefited tremendously from Jim Saruk's research. Jim's a great guy, but he doesn't want to write a book. He's a researcher, and he was perfectly cheerful to let us use this stuff, you know, and put his good research out there in the field. And, you know, lucky us.
Yeah. And we have Shattered Sword, which is an incredible book. And it's just one of those things that you got to go back to over and over again because you keep discovering new things when you read
it. I'm like, yeah, what did happen on that morning? I got my pretty picture up here over on the screen. Anyway,
it's a lot to remember. There's so many moving parts going on at the same damn time. It's I've been studying this event since I was 12. Right. It's hard to keep track of everything.
So let's jump back to the battle. At this point, you've got the, you know, the carrier. And they're rearming the reserve.
Yep.
You know, attack package.
Second strike, yeah.
To strike the island because there's no evidence that there are any aircraft carriers or Navy ships around.
Yep.
And we take it from there.
So just at the time that Nagumo makes this decision that I'm going to rearm my aircraft, lo and behold, the first American planes from Midway show up. Mm-hmm. And that's Burt Ernest and his TBF Avengers and the B-26s come roaring in.
Exactly. So,
They know that they're land-based aircraft, so he's not second-guessing his decision for the second strike at this point.
Yeah, well, and that's going to become, you know, really, really clear to Nagumo. When the B-26s show up, I mean, these are twin-engine bombers. It's like, okay, that's clearly coming from Midway. The Japanese CAP handles these aircraft very, very roughly. They shoot down two of the four B-26s. They shoot down five of the six TBFs. Mm-hmm. It's a massacre. And, you know, Burt Ernest's plane is just absolutely shot to pieces. Mm-hmm. Harry Ferrier, to his dying day, he was the radio man gunner, had a baseball cap, had a little hole right in the forehead where he was creased by a 7.7 millimeter bullet from a Japanese Zero. It knocked him cold. He comes to. He is covered with the blood of the turret gunner above him, who's been killed by a cannon shell from a Zero, crawls up to the cockpit. Burt Ernest is trying to figure out how to keep this plane in the air because all the flaps have been shot away. And they're just about to go in the drink when Ernest realizes, oh, I've still got my trim tabs. I can still make that work. And that gives him enough ability to control the plane that he's able to limp it back at sea level, you know, wave top height back to Midway. The Americans make no hits as a result of these attacks. Although one of the B-26s, there's dispute over what happens there. Fuchida's account says that it, you know, kamikazed itself and just barely missed the island. I personally have come to believe that that was actually one of the B-26s that made a run down the length of Akagi's flight deck and got out of there. Mm-hmm. But either way, it was certainly a real eye-opener on Akagi's bridge to have a twin-engine plane pass by the bridge by just a matter of feet.
The guy, the B-26 that did that very action that you're talking about was piloted by a guy named Jim Murray. Jim Murray, M-U-R-I. Jim Murray lived in Missoula, Montana, I believe it was. And I knew him well. He said that as they were coming in, you know, because they're dropping their fish, or they're trying to drop their fish, and he does so, they're attacked by three or four Zeros, I think, are on the back end of that 26. And it's and their B-26 looks much like Bert Ernest's Avenger. It's shot to hell. And at that point, his only option was to pull up, because he was about to hit the bow of Akagi. He was that low.
Yeah.
Was to pull up, and he just low passes, like airshow style, right across the flight deck of Akagi. And I believe it was his port side wingtip missed the bridge by feet, you know, by feet.
Yeah.
And he does make it back. He and his crew, most of them are wounded. If I remember correctly, and I could be wrong on this, I don't believe anybody in his airplane was killed. They were all wounded, including himself, the pilot Murray. He was wounded too. But they get it back. He ground loops it when he hits Midway. He puts the 26 down and he ground loops it and crawls out of there, literally crawls out of there. But he is one of the only survivors. And then Bird, of course, you know, he's shot to hell.
And these guys were heroes, but they had to have known that they didn't have much of an impact. And, you know,
It's hard to say.
I don't think they did know that, because, you know, there's reports from some of the Midway aviators of them hitting the ships that they attacked. Of course they didn't, but they didn't know that, you know, there was, you know, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, when these things are coming in, when these 26s and Avengers, and then later VMSB 241s with their Vindicators and their SBDs, they're coming in, and these Japanese ships are shooting at them. So there's a lot of smoke and tracer fire and muzzle flashes, and then they're getting hit by Zeros and God knows what else. Yeah. So there's a mass confusion. So, I mean, maybe they hit something. Of course, they didn't. But, I mean, to their, you know, you can understand why they may have thought they may have hit something. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
Bottom line is 10 planes in, no hits, and only three of them get back. So it's just, it's really bloody. So, so that's about, we're at 07:15 now. We're just roaring along here, aren't we?
So the carriers on the American carriers, you know, the pilots, like I said, and the air crew, they're up at 0300. They eat chow, and then they go into their ready rooms and they just sit there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sitting there and they're sitting there and they're sitting there, and they get the reports, you know, the Japanese aircraft carriers are spotted and everything else. But it's not until 6:45 in the morning ish that they finally get the word to man their planes. Now, they'd been on Enterprise. They'd been told to man their planes twice.
Right.
And then recalled and said, no, go back, just hang out for a little bit more. And you can imagine the bladders on these guys, you know, I mean, it's
just dying.
Yeah. So they finally get the word at 6:45 to go man their airplanes. They do that very thing. They run up to the flight deck. They get in their birds. Now, on Enterprise, which is whom I knew most of the guys who flew the strikes from Enterprise, they the first ones to launch is your CAG. That's McCluskey and his two wingmen. And then you got Scouting 6 is the first squadron, the SBD squadron to launch, and they're launched with 500-pound bombs. And then behind them is Bombing 6, Dick Best's people, with 1,000-pound bombs. And then, well, the fighters are gone. VF-6 is already gone. And then, of course, you got VT-6, the almost said Avengers. The Devastators are the last ones to get off the deck. And it Spruance decides to launch at 7. So 15 minutes-ish after they're given the word to man their airplanes, they got to get the hell off of there and get out there in a hurry. And, John, you talked about it before. Fletcher, who has overall command, gives Spruance the word, just when you can, you just go, and we'll catch up with you.
Yep. And I think, you know, here's an example of, you know, Fletcher is a very unselfish commander. He's not trying to micromanage Raymond Spruance. He, even at this point in the battle, he's reasonably confident that Spruance knows what he's doing. And Spruance, likewise, is leaning on his air guys to say, you know, okay, when are we going to be in launch range? And let's build a little padding into that. Because one of the problems the Americans have is, in order to launch aircraft, they have to turn into the wind, which is taking them away from the Japanese. So they're actually putting more miles between them and where they think the Japanese are going to be. during this incredibly protracted launch cycle. Yeah, I mean, we talk about the, you know, the Japanese were able to put up 108 planes in the course of about 10 minutes. The Americans labor for an hour to put up an equal number of aircraft.
Yeah, I was going to say it's the ass opposite of that. And I refer back to February 1st when Enterprise is, you know, I likened her to a conveyor belt where she's launching, recover, launching all day long. Mm-hmm. It's the complete opposite of that today. Now, Enterprise gets her air group aloft in a relatively quick order, but not 10 minutes. But then they circle the task force forever, and they're burning fuel, and they're just waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And but I mean, what is the is there an explanation for this?
I'm not the American guy. I'm just the Japanese.
That's the thing.
They're trying to fly a coordinated strike package.
Well, they're trying.
To go, right?
They weren't any damn sure. good at it. Yeah,
that's they weren't good at it. Right.
They're trying. And I mean, again, you know, I knew these
Enterprise
guys.
Is with Hornet, right?
Yeah. It's
a mess.
It's a mess. Yeah. It's a discombobulated mess. There's a dirtier word for it, but we're not going to use that.
Yeah. And Spruance at one point is just like, just send just the dog on their way.
Just go.
Yeah. So the net result is that you've got three different packages of Enterprise planes up in the air. You've got a group of fighters, you've got the torpedo planes, which go up last, and you've got the dive bombers, which at least are proceeding in two squadron groups. Right. But well, there's three groups of planes just from Enterprise. Hornet is a mess as well, because what's gone on over there is Mark Mitcher, who is the skipper of the Hornet.
He's still a captain at this point, and he is an aviator.
He should
know what he's doing.
Yes, he should know what he is doing. And there's at least some evidence that he's not real happy with the fact that, you know, Fletcher and Spruance are in command of these two task forces,
right,
both of whom are non-aviators. The other thing that got baked into Nimitz's operational plan for the morning is this notion that the Japanese will be operating in two carrier task forces. And it seems that Mitcher took it upon himself, without consulting with Spruance, to take his entire air group, and I'm going to send it searching for that other mythical Japanese carrier task force. So at the end,
because they would never operate four carriers altogether, right? They would do it the way we do it.
Right. So yeah, you got some real mirror imaging going on. Mm. There. But the net result is that Hornet's air group goes up in the air, and instead of proceeding to the southwest, actually flies a course almost due west.
And this becomes the flight to nowhere?
The infamous flight to nowhere.
Okay.
And about, I don't know, what, half an hour into that flight, the torpedo plane squadron leader, John Waldron, VT-8's commander, is just absolutely certain that the air group commander, Stanhope Ring, is going the wrong way and has a violent in-air argument. It's rank and subordination. Let's just call it what it is.
It is, yeah. On an open circuit, by the way.
On an open circuit, you know. Yeah. So you got a lot of these other pilots like, what the hell, you know. And eventually, Waldron takes his entire...
The skipper and the CAG are screaming at each other. This can't be good.
Yeah, and Waldron hauls his formation out of, you know, the main group, and he goes off to the southwest and essentially flips the bird to Stanhope Ring, who then takes the remainder of the dive bombers and the fighters on their merry way off to nowhere.
Mm-hmm. So, for better or worse, the torpedo bombers were right, and
yes,
Waldron finds the carriers.
Yes,
but it's one of those things that it's infuriating, because had Ring, either I wouldn't, he's not going to follow a subordinate officer who says, you know what, up yours, I'm out of here. He's not going to turn that squadron or that formation around.
He's looking forward to the court martial that's going to come.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
And Ring is a bit of a martinet himself. Mm-hmm. And so he's certainly not going to follow a John Waldron, having just been, you know, flipped the bird in midair. Had he done so, though, Hornet's entire air group would have found the Japanese at about 09:17 in the morning. And had things been delivered according to doctrine, Hornet arguably would have knocked out one or probably two of the Japanese carriers. And then, you know, I make the argument in my latest War College article that, you know, Mark Mitcher is responsible for sinking the Yorktown, because Hornet done what it was supposed to do, this whole battle could have been over by lunchtime and the Japanese lose 4-0.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what happened.
So we could talk about Spruance's opinion of Mitcher later, but
Well, so anyway. Bill, here's your moment. At the same time, or roughly thereafter, that the that the American aircraft from Midway strike the Japanese and do nothing, the Japanese fleet is encountered by the USS Nautilus.
Yeah.
Yes.
Lay it on us, man.
If this is my moment, do I get to take credit for all the submarines that did extremely well during the war?
Yes.
Good. All right. Yeah. I mean, these guys are great heroes. Now, they were again, this is early in the war, and for, as background, the interwar submarine force tended to promote very conservative submarine skippers who refrained from getting their submarines sunk by doing dangerous things. And what this did is breed a conservatism in the submarine and submarine leadership that did not serve us well when it became time to be aggressive and to take risks to win the war. Now, I'm not accusing the skipper of Nautilus of being that way. Bottom line is, out of position, didn't close. Doctrine said stay submerged during the daytime. Don't surface. And when you stay submerged, you're lucky if you can do 5 knots, right? You're normally doing 3 knots because the periscope creates this big thing called a rooster tail when you go fast, which makes you really easy to see. But, you know, so by remaining detected, they never closed to a position where they can conduct an effective attack. And so this became an issue for all of the submarines. Remember, there was more than one submarine in this battle. The only one that had anything to do with the outcome was the Nautilus, but not in the way they would have wanted. Yeah. They didn't attack. They were sighted. They didn't conduct an effective attack. They were sighted. And because of that, a destroyer was left behind to prosecute the Nautilus. The Japanese left this destroyer, chase them down, and keep them from interfering with our operations. Because as I wrote decades later in a document called Full Spectrum ASW, it's not necessary to sink the enemy submarines. The only thing you have to do is keep them from interfering with what you want to do. And the Japanese understood this, and that's what they were going to do with the Nautilus.
So there's actually some controversy here because over the years, Arashi, the destroyer Arashi, is credited for having held down Nautilus's head during this time. There's some Japanese sources that say, no, it wasn't Arashi. Arashi's a Desdin leader. They're not going to designate another Tin
destroyer
and do that because we got command issues to deal with. So don't know what ship it was, but yeah, one Japanese destroyer is keeping Nautilus and Commander Brockman's head down during this time.
But the effect of that, whether the attack, and this is the important part here, is the attack by Nautilus, by Brockman's people, was not successful. However, because that they were there, and that destroyer, whichever one it may have been, was detailed to deal with this pest, that plays a huge role in what is going to, I mean, this is massive. So while the attack isn't successful, whether they knew it or not, Brockman and the sub play a massive role in this event.
The destroyer decides it needs to skedaddle and get back with daddy and the carrier force. And so it's hightailing it at flank speed.
Wait, we're going to get there.
We'll see this destroyer again.
Yeah, exactly.
Indeed. So around 8:40, the American attacks for the moment cease.
Yep.
What is Nagumo's timetable looking like now through all these attacks? And there's a lot of them. You know, there's VT-8, the B-26s, VMSB.
VT-8 hasn't shown up yet. So let's
talk. Oh, not VT-8. I'm sorry. I meant VT-8 detached. My bad.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
My bad.
Nagumo's got a real problem he's got to figure out here. I mean, he's made this decision at 07:15, I'm going to rearm my aircraft. Half an hour later, 07:45, lo and behold, Tone's number 4 scout plane comes back and says, hold the phone. There are American ships out here. I've just seen some. And, you know, that is not what they expected to hear. And Nagumo immediately, in clear language, fires back to this aircraft, determine ship types. Because I need to know if these are carriers or not. Okay. And also, as soon as he does that, he sends the word down to the hangar decks, hold everything, switch back to ship attack weapons again. Yeah. Yeah. So now think about what a mess the hangars are at this point. You know, we've gotten through the first third of the aircraft, torpedoes off, bombs on, or maybe we're somewhere in the second chew tide, second third, you know, nobody knows. The situation in the hangar decks is just kind of opaque at this point, but we know it's a confused mess. Mm-hmm. Now Nagumo's got to figure out, okay, am I going to wait to recover my morning strike, which I know is going to have damaged aircraft, they're going to be running low on fuel, do I wait and bring them down first? Because I haven't got a fully armed strike in reserve at this point. You know, I could just go with my dive bombers on Carrier Division 2 and hold back on the torpedo planes and send them out when they're arming. Again, a lot of moving parts. Doctrine says that they want to go with a full meal deal, if you will, in that we'd like to attack with both dive bombers and torpedo planes at the same time. That presents the enemy with a multi-altitude attack that's much harder to repel.
Something we would have liked to have done too if we had capability to actually execute it that way.
And so eventually Nagumo ends up making the decision that, okay, I'm going to recover my morning strike force first. By the time I get them down, I should have my torpedo planes now rearmed, and then I'll put up my reserve birds and I'll go ahead and hit the Americans with a real alpha strike. In retrospect, it probably would have been better for Nagumo to simply launch everything he had, armed or not, just to get it the hell out of the hangars. So that would have meant going with the dive bombers from Carrier Division 2 and probably a bunch of unarmed or semi-armed aircraft from Carrier Division 1. But again, hindsight is 20/20. Nagumo ends up making the decision that is doctrinally congruent. And I think people need to understand that. And also understand just how thin these playbooks were at this point in the war. I mean, you know, no one's fought a lot of carrier battles before. Right. Japanese doctor needing a real thick document. So that's what Nagumo ends up doing is deciding to hold the phone until he can get that reserve force fully on. Bottom line is, he makes the decision, I'm going to recover my morning strike force. Mm-hmm. The Americans go away starting at about 0830, 0840, and he starts bringing those Tominaga's birds down beginning at 0853. There's no question that as soon as they're all down in the course of about a half an hour, he is going to want to start spotting his flight decks with his reserve package to go after the Americans. But lo and behold, as soon as the last of his planes comes down at 0917, lookout starts saying, we've got another American attack coming in, and this is the torpedo planes from the Hornet, VT-8.
Mm-hmm. So VT-8's coming in, not VT-8 detached, but VT-8. These are the guys from the flight deck.
Yeah.
And they received a similar fate, actually worse than anything that's coming from Midway so far.
Yeah. It's just a horrific massacre. These are slow, unescorted TBDs. And the Japanese cap that's up at this point contains some real trigger-men. I mean, these are experienced NCOs, and they just shoot this squadron into pieces. 15 planes in, 15 planes down, one guy left alive in the water.
But Enterprise, help me understand this, Enterprise launched first, and then VT-8 went along with Stanhope Ring on the flight to nowhere before they broke off.
Yeah.
And they still got there before any other Americans?
Yeah.
That's a
he basically had he made a beeline for the Japanese fleet.
Yeah, came right to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like he had knew a where they were. On his nose.
Yeah. And the Enterprise aircraft didn't do that?
Well, some of them did. VT-6 is what, John, 20 minutes, 10 minutes behind VT-8? So, I mean, they're...
Okay.
And again, you got to remember, and this is where it just gets screwed to hell, is that Enterprise is... They launched and formed up as a unit, and then they just kind of just drag away. Wade McCluskey, God bless him, has got the throttle of the firewall, and these SBDs are cooking, and they're leaving these TBDs behind, yet the TBDs still make it to the Japanese fleet before the SBDs ever do.
Yeah, that's because
it's weird.
McCluskey's guys fly further to the southwest and miss the Japanese force. In any case, So yeah, what happens now, starting at, you know, 0920 for the next, you know, hour or so, you've got every 20 minutes, there's an American carrier aircraft attack coming in, and they're all torpedo planes. VT-8 at 0920, VT-6 from Enterprise comes in at about 0940 and is treated nearly as roughly as VT-8.
There's two or three that survive?
Three, I think.
Three.
And then VT-8 is just gay?
Yeah.
Gay.
So we've got one guy left alive in the water here, who famously, you know, makes claims later on that he sees all of the subsequent events of the morning. I think there's a great deal of skepticism among
someone who's spent a career on a submarine with maybe trying to keep 1 foot of periscope above the water. I know what that height of eye allows you to see from in terms of range on the ocean. It's only maybe eight to 10,000 yards, maybe 5 miles. Yeah. And so Gay had to be like within shooting range of these aircraft carriers to see everything that was going on.
Well, and
if what he said was true.
I mean, you know, he drops a torpedo on the Soryu and then makes a beeline to try to get out of there and is shot down, it seems, very quickly. So he goes in the drink, and he probably is in the middle of Kido Butai in some fashion. Kido Butai at this point has been attacked numerous times by B-17s, among others. So the Kido Butai's formation has gotten steadily more dispersed as the morning goes on. It seems that Gay witnessed the Americans or the Japanese bringing aboard some of their aircraft on a carrier. It had to have been either a Kagi or Soryu because, we have the Japanese flight record. Know which carriers were recovering planes. But by the time the big stuff is going to happen later in the morning, Kido Butai has moved well away to the north. I mean, we're talking 12, 15 miles away to the north.
They're over the horizon pretty much.
He couldn't have seen them from that height of eye. No. Okay.
And I mean, you know, the man's floating in the water with a sea cushion.
Under a sea cushion because he didn't want to be seen by
him. Exactly. So, I mean, at best, his head's popping up. I mean, it's the height of your head, you know? I mean,
if there are no swells. If there's swells, you'll see something every 2 to 3 seconds. Yeah. And so then you can't see him, then you can see him. Then swells affect periscopes too.
Carriers, you know, by the time we get to like 10 o'clock in the morning or thereabouts, at best, he might see masts or something like that. They're well past hull down on him anyway. Mm.
But he would have seen the explosions and the smoke and he would have known a lot was going on.
Yeah. And that, you know, that's a little later here, but you know, if we rejoin McCluskey and the Enterprise dive bombers, I mean, by about 9:45 or so in the morning, they show up to where they think they're going to find the Japanese fleet. And there is nothing there, you know, they just puffy white clouds and blue sea as far as the eye can see, and the fuel gauges are running down. It's not looking good. And McCluskey makes a very intelligent decision to start doing a box search, and makes his first leg off to the north. And lo and behold, at about 10 o'clock in the morning, sights a Japanese destroyer. And it is the destroyer that was holding Nautilus's head down during this entire time. And McCluskey, again, being a very wise man, reasons that, you know, if that destroyer is going in a high rate of speed in that direction, I think that's a problem.
Maybe there's something there. Destroyers almost never operate independently.
That's correct. Yeah. So he follows that destroyer home. And at about 10:05 in the morning, lo and behold, there are ships showing up in his windscreen. At the same time, Yorktown's package is coming in from the southeast. They too are sighting smoke from all this anti-aircraft fire that's ongoing during these torpedo plane attacks. And so Yorktown's package, which is a squadron of dive bombers, squadron of torpedo planes, and Jimmy Thatch's six F4Fs trailing along on medium cover, also
inventor of the Thatch weave, as I recall.
We're just about to debut that. So yeah, the net result is that by 10 in the morning, the Japanese carrier force has been sighted by two separate groups of American aircraft, neither of whom have any idea that they are in the neighborhood. And they are now approaching the Japanese from the southwest and the southeast at different altitudes. And this is before the days of radar. We have broken cloud cover here. And the first thing that the Japanese see is Yorktown's torpedo planes, VT-3, coming in from the southeast. And that has the effect of sucking all of the Japanese combat air patrol like a magnet down into the southeast attack vector. And that's going to leave things pretty much wide open for the dive bombers.
So, on that note, though, I mean, VT-6, or it is credited, well, they were lost at this point.
Yep.
But they were credited for sucking the cap down to a low altitude, thereby saving other.
Yeah, that's the myth that, oh, you know, the sacrifice of the torpedo planes was tragic, but they, you know, did this thing. And actually, they didn't do that because the performance character
an hour before.
Yeah. I mean, VT-8 was completely destroyed by about 0937. The dive bomber attack that's going to destroy Kido Butai happens at 10:20. Zero can climb from 0 to 15,000 feet in, like, I don't know, 7 minutes or something like that. So, you know, the Zeros had plenty of time to regain altitude. What the torpedo plane attacks did was they took time off the clock. They prevented Nagumo from spotting his own flight decks, because I don't want to be putting my own aircraft up on a flight deck, one, when my ship is maneuvering violently.
Absolutely, trying to avoid those torpedoes.
You know, that's ugly. And B, you know, fully fueled up aircraft on my flight deck, it would just take one of these American, you know, yahoos to come in and strafe my flight deck and
holy crap, we got fire. You
know, ooh.
Yeah, it doesn't require a bomb, just requires strafing, which is easier. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, the bottom line is that Nagumo has never had the window of opportunity, that 40-minute chunk of time that he needs to get that group of planes up on the flight deck. Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to McCluskey's decision here. And this is something that I've harped on for years and years and years and years. And this is something when I was there at the World War II Museum as a historian for 15 years, I tried to drive into people's heads how important this decision is and was. This is really the only experienced commander you have in the air right now is Clarence Wade McCluskey Jr. He's the only one.
In terms of air group commanders.
Right. Yeah. He's the only guy with any kind of experience at all. And, you know, when he goes to the supposed point of interception and there's nothing there, he is fully aware that the 31 other SBDs behind him are running low on fuel. He's aware of this.
He could also. I mean,
yeah.
Well, that was a situation is dire.
Yeah, I mean, it's a heavy decision that he has to make here, because he knows that if he continues to search too far,
a lot of these
more than half of these planes ain't coming home. And I mean, you know, the chances of finding them out in the middle of the water are slim to none. Yeah. And he takes the ultimate gambler's risk here, in my opinion, and says, "The hell with it. I've got the beef in this formation to kill anything if I can find it." Right. And I'm going to keep on going. And I knew guys like Tony Schneider who were way back in the back of the formation who are constantly jockeying throttle to keep up with, because, I mean, it's like a whip, you know, a formation. The guys at the front are using less fuel, but the guys in the back are using twice as much. And he consequently runs out of fuel as he sees Kido Butai. But I mean, they're running out of gas. Lou Hopkins in bombing six, he knew he was running out of gas. Dusty Cleese, who's 6 planes behind Wade McCluskey, he was in far better situation. Don Hoff in the rear seat of Dexter's plane, he's in better situation. But those guys way in the back, they were in dire straits. And they keep on going. And it's I remember you know, once they see the destroyer, nobody attached the significance to it except for Wade McCluskey. Seemingly, because even Dusty Cleese, who had been in combat, you know, he was a wise pilot. He saw the plane, he saw the destroyer, and he's like, "BFD, it's a destroyer. We're here to kill carriers, not destroyers."
Yeah, and I think that's sort of totally agree. You know, one of the huge decisions of the battle is McCluskey making that decision. It's a great decision. Yeah. The other thing that sort of brings home, it's really hard for us in this day and age to get our heads around just how primitive the navigational aids were in these aircraft this time. I mean, you know, you got your dashboard compass, you got a little paper map the size of, you know, nothing, that's like strapped to your knee. You got a pencil.
And you're reading waves. You're reading the waves. They had a chart. Each pilot had a chart. And you could read the wave tops as to which way the wind was blowing. It was primitive.
Wind speed,
It was primitive, to say the
least. I've said in a number of my lectures, you know, in a day and age where, you know, most of us can't get to the grocery store without Siri whispering in our ear, you know, it's pretty tough.
Right. The theory is, you know, of course, you know, McCluskey breaks doctrine. He was supposed to go. He should have attacked. Yes. He and Scouting 6 should have attacked Akagi Akagi. And then Bombing 6 should have gone after Kaga. And the theory is there was a radio, basically there were two people talking at the same time on a radio. Dick Best and Wade McCluskey were speaking to each other at the same time, and nobody heard what the hell it was they were supposed to hear. Because Dusty Cleese said, I remember him telling me, he said he heard fragments of Earl, all he heard was Earl, you follow me down, from McCluskey. And that was talking to Scouting 6's skipper, Earl Gallagher, who of course draws first blood. But that dive, you know, here you got all these guys setting up. This is the pinnacle of their career. And the first four guys miss.
Well, and, you know, some of that is also in accordance with doctrine. I mean, doctrine says that we're only going to get one hit out of six. And that's pretty much what we get. But before we dive, though, we should just say that the state of the Japanese carriers at this time, and there was a myth that was promulgated for years and years and years by Mitsuo Fuchida that, you know, when the American dive bomber attack comes in starting at about 10:22 in the morning, that the Japanese have now lifted their entire strike force up on the flight decks. They're just minutes away, baby, from, you know, taking off and clobbering the Americans with their own counterattack.
That's how close it was.
It was this close, baby. And unfortunately for Fuchida's account, what the Japanese air group records tell us is that there's no way that that could have happened, because the Japanese were recovering combat air patrol fighters on Akagi. They recover a Shotai of three of those guys at 10:10 in the morning, which is only 15 minutes before Akagi is fatally bombed. Which means that there was no way that they could have gotten the strike force up on the flight deck and warmed up and ready to go.
Right.
So the situation on the Japanese carriers at this point is pretty much the same as it's been for the last hour and a half. We're looking for that window of opportunity to bring our planes up. They may have started bringing up some of the dive bombers in Carrier Division 2. That's not clear in the scholarship at this point, but basically the Japanese are caught pretty much with their pants down. And
when you guys encounter that bit of data, how many times did you go over it until you convinced yourself that this history that had been written for 50 plus years was wrong?
Yeah, I mean, there was some of that. You know, we had to be really, really careful. And the tiebreaker, frankly, was when we became aware that there were some things about Fuchida's account that just didn't jibe with what the air group records were telling us, we sent letters off to Japanese historians that we had gotten to know during this time period. This was 3 years, 4 years into the project. And I send off this letter, and I'm, you know, really careful because I don't want to point fingers at Fuchida and call him a liar, but, you know, can you help me out understand what's going on here? Because I don't quite get it. Letters go out, letters come back. One of the letters from this Japanese guy starts out, to understand why Fuchida's book is a pack of transparent lies.
So didn't miss his words, did he?
Yeah, he was not mincing his words. Basically, what's going on there is, you know, the Japanese are going to lose four aircraft carriers in this battle. And when they go home, there's going to be a little explaining that has to go on.
Absolutely.
Fuchida's book is, you know, he's kind of the front man of this cabal of First Air Fleet officers that are trying to think up, you know, can we come up with a story that doesn't make us look quite so bad?
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, it's nicer to portray us as having been this close, baby, you know, and then the gods of war come in and take it all away from us, rather than, yeah, our scouting plan was kind of screwed up and, you know, mistakes were made. So, anyway. That's what's happening.
So as the SBDs roll, and they for the most part, they do roll over into their dives. This is something big, and it's something that's in your book that I refer to often, John. It's that when the SBDs and the Vindicators came in the morning from VMSB 241, they did a glide bombing attack, both groups. And it was very clear that the pilots and the aircraft were underperforming.
Yep.
You know, not doing what they needed to do. However, these guys are pros, and they're coming in at 75, 80 degree dives.
Yes.
And they're falling like a rock onto these Japanese aircraft carriers. The first guy to draw blood is Scouting Six's skipper, Earl Gallagher, or at least that's the thought. The first guy to draw blood is Earl Gallagher. He plants a bomb on Kaga towards her stern, does he not?
I think that's right. Yep.
Ish.
Yeah. Right. Ish. Crew accommodations actually on that. Right.
Then he set a bunch of mattresses and things afire.
Everything on a carrier is flammable.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly.
World War II carrier. I mean, the bottom line in for Kaga is she's just on the receiving end of a double-barreled attack. You know, she should only be getting one squadron coming down on her. She's getting the better part of two. Mm-hmm. Kaga is not a particularly handy vessel. You know, she's a converted battleship, and she, I think, as we put in the book, you know, she turns like an oxen before the plow. You know, so this ship doesn't have a prayer in hell avoiding, you know, two dozen dive bombers coming down on her. Although, as you say, you know, the first four bombs miss her.
Right.
But when they do start to hit her, they just blow her to hell and gone.
Well, the one that really, at least again, the thinking is the one that, according to your numbers in your book and the guys that I knew, the one who really puts the first real hard lick on Kaga is Dusty Cleese.
Yeah.
He aims for the national emblem, the national ensign on the bow of the flight deck or near the
rising sun.
Yeah. And he,
Hinamaru, they call it. Yeah.
The Hinamaru, yeah. Right. And Hinamaru. He puts his bomb, from all accounts, right at the edge of that sucker. I mean, he just barely misses hitting dead center.
Does make a nice target.
It does. And that bomb, if from what I understand, obviously it penetrates a 500 pounder, penetrates the flight deck and explodes in the hangar deck amongst those airplanes in that enclosed hangar deck. And it just wreaks havoc.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the images that I've had since I was a child is, you know, what would it have been like to be on the hangars of those carriers when those bombs come?
You don't want to be there.
Deck above you. Hopefully it was quick. But yeah, I mean, these hangars are packed chock-a-block with aircraft that are fully fueled. The fueling system is in operation. And in a lot of cases, there's extra ordnance. You know, there are torpedoes that were on these birds in the morning that they didn't have time to stow below. And so they're sitting by the side of the, you know, over on the bulkheads. It's a catastrophe.
It's something that I thought about as a, you know, as I've been going through this for years and years and years. When you're a kid and you have firecrackers and you take a little black cat and you light it and you fling it in the air and it goes pow, you know.
Yeah.
And then
Well, then
you're a kid, and you know, being a boy like myself, and I was growing up, I wanted to destroy things. So what do? Is you take that black cat and you stick it down a beer can.
Yeah.
And then you light it. And what does it do? Boom. You know, it's significantly larger. Or at least louder and more violent explosion, even from that little bitty old firecracker. Now imagine that with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 500-pound bombs.
Right.
It was a big pipe bomb.
These hangars are enclosed.
Enclosed. No place for the vapor to escape.
Exactly. And nowhere for blast overpressure to go either. I mean, American carriers had, you know, doors along the side
that like garage doors
designed. Mm-hmm. Blow out in the case of an explosion. The Japanese haven't got that. So yeah, it's like putting, you know, a 500 pound bomb into a beer can. It just blows these things to pieces, scythes down, you know, anybody that's on that flight deck. In Kaga's case, ruptures fuel mains and creates a situation very akin to what happens to Franklin later on in the war. So you've got high temperatures, rapidly vaporizing aviation fuel, which within about 4 to 5 minutes after the initial attack creates an enormous fuel air explosion on board Kaga. It just, you know, there were American aircraft that were exiting after this attack that, you know, saw this explosion and were like, well, the ship would just disintegrate. And that's not true. But from their perspective, you know, how could anything survive an explosion of that magnitude?
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah, Kaga's just, they stopped counting. That no one knows how many bombs she was hit by. Because again, these scout planes coming down with a 500-pound bomb, they also have 2 100-pounders strapped on the wings, and getting hit by 100 pounds of TNT isn't exactly a walk in the park either. God knows how many bombs hit Kaga. She's just devastated.
Yeah.
Real surprise for the morning is, of course, okay, Kaga is getting hit with essentially two squadrons of planes, but Kagi, isn't getting anybody's loving, helpful, you know, spoonfuls until Dick Best, who's the commander of Bombing Squadron 6, has just gotten his dive spoiled by Gallagher and the guys coming down in front of him. He pulls up, grabs two of his wingmen out of their dive. So he's got a grand total of 3 planes now, and recognizes that Kagi is getting off scot-free, and that will not do. And it's important to understand the implications here. If Akagi does get off scot-free, that means that her torpedo plane squadron, which is manned by Commander Murata, who's the best torpedo plane pilot in the Navy, you know, they're going to be added into the mix later this afternoon for counterstrikes. So it's very important to put Akagi out of business. He goes and hustles over.
He doesn't know that, though, right?
No, he doesn't know it. All he knows is that he's got
this carrier, and nobody's carrier attacking.
I've got the situational awareness to recognize that someone's got to hit that damn carrier, because it was supposed to be his job, and now I guess it's mine.
Yeah.
So he goes over and attacks her. He's not able to go into a sequential dive. They come down in a vic of 3 planes, and if you look at the way that the splash comes down, it's the center plane that almost certainly hits that ship, and that's Dick Best. He's a consummate pilot. I mean, he was one of the best damn pilots in the Navy, and he just nails Kagi with one 1,000-pound bomb right in the middle elevator. Goes right into the fueled aircraft there, and that's pretty much it for Kagi.
And then somehow, according to the movie, magically lands on the carrier 30 minutes after he would have run out of fuel.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, to the north, you know, Yorktown's planes are doing their thing. VT-3 is coming in, going after Hiryu, is not successful, takes very heavy casualties in the process. But then VB-3 comes around, loops around, attacks Soryu out of the northeast. A full squadron against that carrier ends up putting 3 bomb hits, 1,000-pound bomb hits, neatly spaced.
Yeah, they walk them down.
Yeah, right down the middle of the flight deck. And the middle of those 2 bombs apparently penetrates not only through the 2 hangar bits, but into the space between the hangars and the engineering spaces. And it is a knife through her heart. Her engines go offline right now. And she starts drifting to a halt. She's immediately without power and a fire from stem to stern. So in the course of 5 minutes, you've completely KO'd 3 of these aircraft there.
3/4 of the attacking air of the Japanese. And it's such a, I'm not going to say it's a miracle, because
it isn't,
because it takes skill.
But there's a lot of luck involved.
I wasn't going to say but it takes a lot of skill. You know, I mean, you know, people have said, oh, it was a miracle we hit those carriers. No, it isn't. It's not a miracle at all. And when you got guys like Dusty Cleese, and you got guys like Dick Best, James Dexter, Earl Gallagher, Max Leslie, it's not luck. That is skill. These are the cream of the crop for the United States Navy.
Yep.
You talk about Murata, you talk about Tominaga and people like that. These are the cream of the crop of the U.S. Navy right here. And they did what they were trained to do, and they did it very, very, very well.
Yep.
Very well. And it's a tribute to them that it was turned out the way it did. It really did. I mean, was it luck that everybody kind of arrived on the scene at the same time? Yes.
For sure.
Yes, it was.
But you can make the argument, too, that even if the Japanese had seen Enterprise's squadrons coming in,
they weren't getting away
a hell of a lot that there was going to be able to do about it. Yeah. You know, once a dive bomber has gone into its dive, as we say in the book, it is an insuperable weapon
system. It's ballistic.
The fire control arrangements and the anti-aircraft guns of the time just
not going
to
catch it.
Have to do with a dive bomber, it's moving so fast, it's changing altitude so quickly that, you know, you've only got about a 15 to 20 second engagement window on this thing,
and maybe
250 knots. That's a very, very hard target to hit.
And what the Japanese are facing too in terms of aircraft, this is, in my opinion, next to the F-6F Hellcat, this is probably the finest carrier-borne aircraft of the United States Navy's inventory in the entire World War II era, which is the SBD Douglas Dauntless Dive Bomber. I mean, this thing was designed to do this particular mission, and it did it with utter precision.
Yeah.
And I mean,
it's great.
It was fantastic. I mean, my favorite. But I mean, you talk about, you know, the dives in a Dauntless or any dive bomber, but especially a Dauntless. You got guys that are coming down at 75 and 80 degrees. I mean, that's
or more.
Or more. Yeah, for instance,
8,000, 10,000 foot roller coaster, and you've got your back seater, you know,
just rotate a seat so he's facing forwards because we can deal with the G's as they pull out.
So a lot of them did not because they were expecting combat air patrol. So like Don Hoff, who's a rear seater in Scouting 6, he was facing backwards. He's riding backwards the whole way. Yeah. They had an altimeter on that part of the SBD where he could, and his job was to hold the mic and count off, you know, altitude. 11, 12 or back other way around, you know, 14, 13 down. And each second is 1,000 feet. Yeah. And, you know, they're dropping it between 1400 and 1100 feet. It basically depended on how long the pilot wanted to, you know, how big his balls were. Let's be real. And as he's going down,
way down. Yeah.
As Dexter, Hoff's pilot, is going down, this is Dexter's baptism of fire, as it is Hoff's. He's going down and he goes down at a 90 degree angle and he actually rolls the SPD onto its back.
He's inverted,
diving on this damn thing, and it's throwing negative G's in the rear seat of the SPD. I remember Don saying that he's sitting there counting off the altitude and he's watching the two ammunition belts for the A&M 230 calibers out. He said they looked like a couple of cobras. They were coming out the ammo cans, and he's slapping them back in the can with one foot and one hand, and he's counting off the altitude. And as he pulls out, Dexter actually kind of blacked him out a little bit because he pulled out so hard.
Yeah, you're talking 7, 8, 9 G's without a G suit.
Yeah. And as he pulls out, the first thing, you know, when he comes to, he sees is Kaga, and she's just boom, 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 boom. And all of a sudden his pilot hears this horrible noise, like something like they're getting shot. And Dexter apparently, you know, got on the intercom and said, "What in the hell is that?" And it was the ammunition flapping against the side of the Dauntless. And they were his belts were beating the crap out of the side of the airplane. So he had to hurry up and get them back in the airplane, put them back in the can so he could fend off the zeros coming down. So, I mean, this is chaos going down through there for every pilot. And they still managed to do what they did.
That also helps explain, though, why a lot of the aviator accounts that come out of this don't necessarily jive. I mean, for years and years and years, you know, Yorktown's guys were like, "Oh, we never attacked Soryu. That was a little carrier. We got, you know, Kaga or one of the other ones." So you're getting shot at. You're on this roller coaster. There's a lot of kabooming going around. Mm-hmm. It's really tough to keep
it. It's a mess. Well, we're starting to run along, so let's fast forward. Let's fast forward. Enterprise and Yorktown land their strikes. Hiryu, the only survivor, launches a strike against the last known report of an American aircraft carrier, which of course is the Yorktown. And they come in twice.
Yes. First attack is their dive bomber squadron under a guy named Kobayashi. Mm-hmm. This is another very experienced aviator, and they deliver a real hurtin' to Yorktown. But in the course of that attack, they are shellacked by first fighters and anti-aircraft fire on their way down. So they deliver a number of pretty bad hits to Yorktown, and had her fuel lines not been secured, you know, I think she would have burned to the waterline too.
Well, they put her down in the water too.
Lesson learned at Coral Sea, was it?
I'm sorry?
Was that a lesson learned at Coral Sea?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, carbon dioxide in the fuel lines to keep the Japanese didn't learn that lesson. It was good for us.
So when Kobayashi is beating feet and he's going back to hear you, he turns around and he sees Yorktown. She's not dead in the water yet, but she's drifting to a stop.
Yeah, he thinks he's knocked her out.
He believes he's killed her.
Yeah.
So he gets back, he lands, and then
they're getting ready with what they've got left. Okay, so you know, we've just lost three of our aircraft carriers. You know, the grand total of strike planes that we have left to our name at this point is just Hiryu's. So they've got one refugee torpedo plane from Akagi. They've got nine birds torpedo planes on Hiryu. They got Tominaga's bird has got a hole in one of the fuel tanks and doesn't have the range to get out and back, although he probably did. Anyway, they go in for a second attack later on in the afternoon. They're told to look for an undamaged American carrier. And lo and behold, in the interval between the dive bomber attack and Tominaga's attack, Yorktown's damage control is good enough that they can get her back up to speed. And so Tominaga ends up going after Yorktown again.
Yeah. And that's something I want to talk about in our next episode, because we don't have the time to do it today. But the damage control, the DC parties on Yorktown worked a damn near miracle. They really did. And I mean, had it not been for that torpedo attack, Yorktown would have made it back to Pearl Harbor. There's no doubt. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt. And she would have, who knows what the rest of the carrier battles of 42 would look like with two experienced, you know, Enterprise and Yorktown in at Guadalcanal. But she didn't. Yeah. She comes in, they take how many torpedo hits, John? Two. Yeah. And that is what really knocks her out. She's not sunk.
She's listing and she has to be abandoned. And that means Fletcher's got to go over the side as well. So yeah, she's out of the fight at this point. And Fletcher, you know, very much to his credit, again, a very unselfish gentleman, you know.
Hands come out off to Spruance.
Yeah, Spruance is like, you know, what are your orders? And Fletcher's like, we'll conform to your movements. In other words, you got the ball, you're doing good. You know, keep going, son.
Yeah.
Very Nimitz-like, I might say.
Yeah. Hiryu during this time is trailing along in the wake of Nagumo. Nagumo has moved his flag off of Akagi onto a light cruiser, has gathered up what surface forces he has because he's a torpedo guy. And he's like, well, the only way I can turn this thing around is to create some sort of a surface fight. Mm-hmm. So he's charging the Americans with his surface forces, trying to bridge that physical gap. Hiryu, under Yamaguchi, the commander of Carrier Division 2, basically trails in her wake the entire afternoon and closes the range as well, which is just ridiculous and stupid. And I'm sorry, I'm just going to call it like it is. If you are one carrier and you're up against what has to be two enemy carriers, you want to be putting as much distance between you and the enemy as possible. Yes, I want a counterpunch, but I want to do it from a distance, because when my aircraft goes into an attritional spiral that I can't get out of, I want to be close to the exit so that I can tip my hat and ride into the sunset. That is not what the Japanese do. Mm-hmm. And the result is that, you know, the range is very, very close. And once the Americans recover their aircraft and are able to put up additional scouting forces, you know, it's just a matter of time before they're going to find Hiryu, and they do. And they still have, you know, 60 operational dive bombers by the late afternoon, and they put up another strike from Enterprise and Hornet, go out looking for Hiryu, and they find her around supper time and hit her with four bombs.
Yeah, they lay waste, and it's mostly this, not all of the same guys that took part in the morning operation, but it's a lot of them.
Yeah.
McCluskey gets hit physically, like he gets hurt in the dive, well, probably on the pullout from the Kaga attack, because they do get attacked by some combat air patrol, McCluskey does. And so he gets, regardless of this, he gets hit. He does not lead the strike in on Hiryu. Earl Gallagher does. And he's going with, I can't think, I just drew a blank, the Yorktown, is it Bottomley? DeWitt Shumway,
thank you.
Yeah, DeWitt Shumway he leads Yorktown's group in there, because Max Leslie had to put his airplane down in the water.
Correct.
And as did his XO, yeah, because they ran out of juice. And
Yorktown's group, but not off of Yorktown.
Say again?
Not off of Yorktown, though.
Correct. Yeah. Right. Being launched from Enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they all come home. Enterprise.
And Dick Best goes out as well. And mm-hmm. yeah, so we've got an occasion here where we have two pilots from the American carriers, Dick Best and Dusty Cleese, that both nail two Japanese carriers during this afternoon.
Right.
This is going to be Dick Best's last mission because his,
right. His lung disease.
Yeah. He gets,
it was actually a rebreather system. I think it was on those airplanes. And then it was a caustic chemical that would remove the carbon dioxide. Yeah. It was just,
triggered his latent tuberculosis.
Correct. Yeah, tuberculosis.
Out of the Navy.
Yeah, put him out of the Navy.
Yeah, but the bottom line is, yeah, they put four 1,000-pound bombs into the forward part of the hangar deck and just turn it into an A-frame. And yeah, that's the end of Hiryu. And that's pretty much the end of the battle as far as the Japanese are concerned. I mean, there's going to be a lot of, you know, hand-wringing and hair-pulling. You know, they don't fully call it off until well after midnight, but you know, that's it.
Yeah. It's, and I hate to run through the rest because I want to talk about it all, and we will, but we just can't do it today because we're running way long.
Way long.
But, as you said, John, as the sun is setting on the 4th of June, it's the battle's, for all intents and purposes, over. Four Japanese carriers are burning.
Yes.
All their aircraft are gone.
Yes.
A great many of those pilots are gone. Some of them are pulled out of the water.
The majority of them, there's going to be 110 Japanese aviator fatalities in this battle. That's about a quarter of the aviators that come into this battle. And the majority of them are from Hiryu. Hiryu's two attack squadrons just are annihilated, and a lot of her fighter pilots as well. But, you know, this, and we'll talk about this in the long-term implications portion of the battle. The other thing we should say, though, about in terms of command decisions, yes, the sun is setting. And the last thing that Raymond Spruance has got to figure out to do today is, where do I want my carriers to be tomorrow morning? And he has to make a decision as to whether or not he's going to run his carriers to the west through the night to be in a position to follow up on his victory in the morning and really pummel the Japanese. Or does he think that the Japanese might have surface forces out gunning for him this evening, and therefore a more conservative approach would be to hold himself at arm's distance throughout this evening? That sort of wrong foots him for tomorrow. He very wisely remembers Nimitz's calculated risk instruction and realizes that there is nothing that he can do tonight that warrants.
It's worth the risk.
You got it. And so he puts himself at arm's length, which is wise because the Japanese were out gunning for him in the evening hours.
Yep. And that would have been bad news.
Bad news.
That would have been bad news.
20 minutes under a battleship's guns and that could be it. You know, I could lose two more carriers just like that.
Oh, yeah. And a lot more, too. Yeah. Well, I hate to cut the fascinating and exciting conversation off, but we have to. We got to cut it off.
You're not cutting it short. We're just cutting it off.
No, we're not. But John, you're going to be back with us next week?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. We're going to wrap it up. We're going to give the implications of this battle, the significance, and how we look at it through history. And we'll tie it in a neat little bow next week. So with that, I want to thank you for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast wherever you receive your podcast and give us a rating and review. We certainly would appreciate it. Also, if you want to see the video version of this and any of our other episodes, subscribe to our YouTube channel called the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. If you have a comment or a question, send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. And once again, I want to thank you all very much for listening. I'm Seth Paradin. Bill?
Yeah, and thanks, John. Really enjoyed it.
Love being here. It was super fun. Thanks for having me.
Cool, guys. We'll see you all next week. Thanks.
Take care.